From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Memorial Day is the start of the summer season, and one of this summer's big movie releases is Men in Black 2. On today's Fresh Air, an interview with one of the film's stars, Will Smith. He received an Academy Award nomination for his starring role in Ali, which just came out on video and DVD. Also, as the NBA season climaxes, we hear from one of the greatest basketball players in the history of the game, Bill Russell. During his 13 years with the Boston Celtics, he helped lead his team to 11 championships. And rock historian Ed Ward tells us about the independent British label Stiff. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush marked Memorial Day on the beaches of Normandy. He linked the sacrifices made in the Second World War to those of the war against terrorism. Nick Spicer reports from Paris.
President Bush flew in a helicopter over the beaches where 58 years ago Allied troops began the liberation of Europe. Then he gave a speech in honor of those who died during the assault in the Normandy American Cemetery, in front of row upon row of white tombstones. Bush linked that giant battle to current efforts in Afghanistan, saying those nations America once helped free were now helping America.
Our security is still bound up together in a transatlantic alliance, with soldiers in many uniforms, defending the world from terrorists at this very hour.
Earlier in the day, French President Jacques Chirac made a speech alongside Mr. Bush in the first town American troops freed, Sainte-Mère-Église. He said France would help the U.S. in the war against terrorism, and they would win it. Nick Spicer, NPR News, Paris.
The Palestinian Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade has claimed responsibility for a suicide bombing in a suburb of Tel Aviv. Israeli police said the bomber killed himself and two Israelis at an outdoor cafe. The dead included a two-year-old girl. The blast injured more than 20 people, including at least three infants. The Palestinian Authority condemned the attack, saying that such attacks are counter to the interests of the Palestinian people. Meanwhile, Palestinians said an Israeli tank shot and killed a 17-year-old Palestinian boy today in Gaza. Florida Governor Jeb Bush will receive a report tomorrow recommending changes to his state's troubled child welfare agency. Jay Edwards reports from member station WQCS.
Governor Bush ordered the panel to find out how the case of missing 5-year-old foster child Rilia Wilson went unnoticed for over a year. The 4-member panel looked into the problems at the Florida Department of Children and Families and has prepared a formal report. In it, the panel lists 21 immediate actions that it says the Florida DCF should implement in order to prevent future department failures. Among the recommendations is a call for a special legislative session to address DCF problems, a pay raise for social workers and their supervisors, plus requiring caseworkers to personally visit every child under supervision at least once a month. The case has become a tough issue for Governor Bush and his reelection bid since he had promised to fix the agency during his campaign 4 years ago. For NPR News, I'm Jay Edwards in Fort Pierce, Florida.
The process of recovering bodies from beneath a collapsed bridge in Oklahoma has been suspended because of an approaching thunderstorm. Before the delay, searchers managed to recover a fourth body using a crane to hoist the victim's car from the muddy water. Authorities say as many as 12 people may have plunged to their deaths when a barge hit the bridge yesterday. This is NPR News. Firefighters in Arizona are working to prevent a wind-driven wildfire from destroying homes. Authorities say the blaze in the Coronado National Forest has now moved to within a half mile of about 175 houses in an area called Mount Lemmon. About 100 residents were forced to leave their homes yesterday. Firefighters are trying to keep the fire from jumping a highway to a point where it could threaten as many as 700 homes. The fire, which has been burning since last Tuesday at least, has now spread to about 14,500 acres. In Columbus, Ohio, $1.8 million is being sought for a new memorial to the Tuskegee Airmen, the first all-black flying unit in the U.S. military. Eileen LeBlanc reports from member station WYSO.
In July of 1941, the Army Air Corps, which would become the Air Force, began to train African Americans to be pilots. By the end of World War II, 992 men had gone through the training at Tuskegee, Alabama, and 450 of them had gone overseas into combat. After the war, the unit was based at what is now Rickenbacker Airport near Columbus until it was disbanded after President Truman ended racial segregation in the military. The new memorial at the airport would include a plaza with the names of the airmen engraved, and a P-51 fighter plane bearing the slogan, "Double Victory at Home, Abroad," referring to the airmen's fight not only against the enemy overseas, but racial segregation in the States. For NPR News, I'm Eileen LeBlanc in Yellow Springs, Ohio.
Coalition troops in Afghanistan observed Memorial Day by dedicating a chapel to the 51 U.S. and Canadian soldiers who've been killed since the start of the Afghan war. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, seeking to improve people's lives by supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and child abuse prevention.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Memorial Day is the start of the summer season. One of the big movies coming out this summer is Men in Black 2, starring my guest Will Smith. Smith received an Academy Award nomination for his role as Muhammad Ali in the film Ali, which has just come out on video and DVD. We're going to hear an interview I recorded with Smith last December when Ali was released. The movie begins in 1964, the year Ali won the World Boxing Association championship by defeating Sonny Liston. Soon after his victory, he announced that he had converted to Islam and was changing his name from Cassius Clay to Muhammad Ali. Will Smith had to work on his boxing moves to play Ali, but he already knew how to rhyme. He was still a teenager when, under the name The Fresh Prince, he teamed up with DJ Jazzy Jeff and started having rap hits like Parents Just Don't Understand. He started his acting career as the star of the sitcom The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. His subsequent movies include 6 Degrees of Separation, Men in Black, Independence Day, and Enemy of the State. Let's start with a scene from Ali. Cassius Clay is weighing in, preparing to fight Sonny Liston, taunting Liston with his rhymes.
Sonny Liston, you ain't no champ! You're a chump! Float like a butterfly, sting like a bee! Ah! Rumble, young man, rumble! Y'all wanna lose y'all money? Then you bet it on Sonny. He know I'm great, he will fall in eight! Come on, you big ugly bear, I'll whoop you right now!
Two 10 and a half. 2 10 and a half. The challenger, Cassius Clay, 210 and a half pounds.
Man, you showed us right. Oh, ugly bear, come on, let's go. You got all these folks fooled. I ain't scared of you.
218. Sonny Liston, the champion of the world. 218 pounds.
Pounds of what?
Pounds of ugly. That man's so ugly, when he sweat, the sweat run backwards off his forehead just to stay away from his face. Come on, you big ugly bear, I'll turn you into a rug.
Will Smith, welcome to Fresh Air. So what did you have to do different to get Ali's voice when Ali was doing his rhymes or just, you know, doing his bragging thing?
Well, essentially, his voice, he has a really big, wide open chest, which gives you that really heavy resonance, but he constricts his throat, which gives you a really sort of higher pitch nasally sound. So I had dialect instructors that were teaching me how to technically where to place my tongue and how to hold my teeth and all of that in order to create the sound that Muhammad Ali created with his voice. So I mean, after a while, it became natural, but in the beginning, it was really constricted and really affected, and, you know, trying to stand up straight and trying to keep my chin down and all of those special little tricks that they taught me to create the sound.
Can you demonstrate what you did with your voice?
Can I demonstrate? Well, then I'd have to charge you my full fee.
Right. Well, fair enough. Do you feel like you learned more about how to brag by playing Ali?
Well, I was pretty good before I started the movie.
Right.
You know, the thing that I think Ali and I have in common as far as being able to say things that might be seemingly perceived arrogant or cocky or offensive is the sense of humor. When you add humor to the comments, sometimes it makes it easier for people to handle and easier for people to digest. And there's certain things that other people just simply couldn't say that I can get away with or Ali can get away with because of the level of comedy that's involved.
Part of what Ali deals with is how Muhammad Ali became political, why he refused to fight in Vietnam, how he became a Muslim. Let's hear another scene from the film. And in this film, he's telling the press why he refuses to fight in Vietnam.
Are you going to dodge the draft?
I ain't draft dodging, I ain't burning no flag, and I ain't running to Canada. I'm staying right here. You want to send me to jail? Fine, you go right ahead. I've been in jail for 400 years. I could be there for four or five more. But I ain't going no 10,000 miles to help murder and kill other poor people. If I want to die, I'll die right here, right now, fighting you. If I want to die, you my enemy. Not no Chinese, no Viet Cong, no Japanese. You my poser when I want freedom. You my poser when I want justice. You my poser when I want equality. Want me to go somewhere and fight for you? You won't even stand up for me right here in America, for my rights and my religious beliefs. You won't even stand up for me right here at home.
Will Smith, of the things that you learned about Ali and his politics and his conversion to Islam, and of the things you learned about the politics of the period, what had the greatest influence on you? Did any of that change your mind on anything or get you thinking about things you hadn't thought about before?
Well, up until that point, I'm a child of essentially the 80s and 90s, so the 60s are really foreign. And Michael Mann brought in a gentleman named Geronimo Gigiga, formerly Geronimo Pratt of the Black Panthers. And he explained the young Black radical point of view to me in a way that I never had understood. He said, war had been declared on Black America. He said, yeah, fire hoses, dogs, domestic terrorism, the bombings of the church. He says, that's war. We were at war in America. And that concept really made a lot of sense. And it became clear how the times really dictated and demanded a Muhammad Ali. Of course, Muhammad Ali is not going to go fight in Vietnam because he's fighting a war in America. I'm not going to go to Vietnam and fight some people that I don't even know when my women and children are being attacked and beaten and killed here. I'm at war here. I can't fight two wars at one time. So let's finish this one up, and then we'll talk about that other one. And that concept of war being declared on Black America was the concept that really gave me a more accurate picture of the 60s and helped me to understand Muhammad Ali's necessity for the connection with the Nation of Islam and the necessity for the strength of his spiritual convictions.
My guest is Will Smith. He's starring as Muhammad Ali in the new movie Ali. You had a record a few years ago, I Think I Can Beat Mike Tyson, where you tell Don King to set up a match at the Trump, and you have this whole fantasy thing. Yeah. So let's hear an excerpt of that record.
Hey, Leroy.
Yeah?
Did you hear about that boy Mike Tyson?
Mike Tyson, he the boy that played football for Montreal, ain't he?
No, you old coop, he a boxer, man. Yeah. Let me tell you, I went to his fight a couple months ago. I seen him hit that boy. He hit the boy so hard, his head flew off into the 18th row. He had to go get his head out the 18th row.
One night about 8, and we were watching a couple of Mike Tyson fight tapes. Jeff was like,
man, you see how hard Mike's punching?
Come on, Jeff, the other guy was just lunging. Left, right, another KO. Ooh. If that was me, I'd have been okay, though. The very next day, I gave Russell a ring with JL and Lior, and we all called Don King.
I said, yeah, Don, I got a problem.
Tell him, Prince.
Yeah, what's up? What you saying? You trying to solve him? Forget the small talk. Let's get to the nitty-gritty. Me and Mike, 2 months. Trump, Atlantic City.
Yo, you got this. You gonna bust dude up.
Yeah, you can be my trainer.
Word up?
I'm rough like a freight train, smooth like ice. And yo, Jeff, straight up, I think I can beat Mike Tyson.
Man, you could beat him, man.
Oh, man, word.
You could beat him, man.
You know, I put on a couple pounds, man. We can do
So Will Smith, in your fantasy of fighting Mike Tyson, you take such a beating in the first round. You punch your coach so you can run away from the ring. Were you much of a fighter?
Not really. I never was a good fighter. But I guess at about 12 or 13 years old, I was in school and I got into a fight in school with a guy named Jason Murphy, and he punched me square in the middle of my nose with all he had, and I realized that it only took a second for me to clear up. And while I was standing there realizing that it didn't really hurt that bad, he punched me again. And I was, it was a strange moment, but it was when I discovered that I could take a punch. And the second that I realized I was like comfortable getting hit, I became a better fighter tenfold. And I think that really helped me in this project, that not being scared to get hit is the center of what makes a fighter be able to be in a rugged war in the ring, because you already know that you're going to get hit. So your approach to that, you got to be in a position to get hit in order to hit somebody. And, fortunately, Ali didn't get hit a lot, but that mindset of not running and not being scared is hugely important to be successful in the ring.
So did you have to actually take punches for the shoot?
Yeah, we decided very early on that there would be no movie fighting in this film, that all of the fighting was going to be real punches, real fighting. We would essentially do it like a stunt. You set it up, you get five or six cameras going, and when we got in the ring, we looked at each other, gave each other a pound, and went at it. And I think when people see the film, they'll be really shocked and amazed at how authentic the boxing is, because there's no fake punches. Every time it looks like somebody got hit, it looks that way because somebody got hit.
But they didn't get hit as hard as they would if it was a real match.
Oh, no. Everybody's getting cracked.
Right.
No, when you say, there's a... Talking about it is one thing. When people see the film, they will understand. You can't fake sweat flying off of somebody's head, and there's none of that slow motion and all that. It's good, clean shots.
Now, when Ali got punched, he didn't know that this was going to happen a few minutes before it did. Whereas in this scene, you get hit hard. So does that help to know that it's coming?
Yeah, that's worse. That is much worse. That's what I told Ali. I told him making this movie was way tougher than any of those fights that he had in real life. I said, you didn't know Joe Frazier was about to knock you down, but I knew James Toney was about to clip me good.
So what do you do to prepare for that?
You bite down on your mouthpiece really hard. You don't want to have your mouth hanging open when you get hit. And, you'd be surprised how, and it's a really weird feeling. I know it sounds bizarre, but there's something that's really cathartic about getting hit and standing up. Somebody knocks you down and you get yourself back together and you stand up again. There's something really, there's an animalistic quality that creates something inside of you when you stand up again.
What was the worst punch you took?
It was the James Toney left hook, the one where Ali gets knocked down by Joe Frazier. Because essentially we had all agreed earlier that again, there's no movie fighting. So I went to James Toney before we did it. And I said, listen, this is for our families. This is for our children. This is for Ali's legacy. I said, so don't play with it. Go ahead, throw the punch in there. Let's get it good and let's go home. And he said, all right, man, I'll let it happen. I said, oh, and by the way, and then I just punched him in the nose right before the take. And he was like, okay. But that may not have been the best idea. He laid into it pretty nicely on me.
My guest is actor and rap star Will Smith. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Will Smith, recorded last December after the release of the film Ali. It's just come out on video and DVD. This summer, he'll star in Men in Black 2. I'm going to go back to your early career.
Mm-hmm.
As we mentioned before, Ali's rhymes were always about how great he was and how he was going to defeat his opponent. And your early raps were very funny, very self-deprecating.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a time in rap. I mean, it's always been that time in rap where raps have been mostly about either bragging about how great your rhymes are, bragging about what a great lover you are, or bragging about how tough you are, or how many women you have, whatever. But your really breakthrough record, Parents Just Don't Understand, was about getting taken to the shopping mall by your mother who wants to buy you all these awful clothes that are going to ruin your credibility.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, why don't we hear a little bit of that?
You know, parents are the same, no matter time, no place. They don't understand that us kids are going to make some mistakes. So to you other kids all across the land, there's no need to argue. Parents just don't understand. But one year, my mom took me school shopping. It was me, my brother, my pop, and my little sister all hopped in the car. We headed downtown to the Gallery Mall. My mom started bugging with the clothes she chose. I didn't say nothing at first, I just turned to my nose. She said, "What's wrong? This shirt costs $20. I said, "Mom, the shirt is plaid with a butterfly collar." The next half hour was the same old thing. My mother buying me clothes from 1963, and then she lost her mind and did the ultimate. I asked her for Adidas and she bought me Zips. I said, "Mom, what are you doing? You ruined my rep." She said, "You're only 16. You don't have a rep yet." I said, "Mom, let's put these clothes back, please." She said, "No. You go to school to learn, not for a fashion show." I said, "This is a shot."
That's the Fresh Prince, Will Smith. Will Smith, how did you end up taking that direction in your early rap records and going the self-deprecating route and admitting that you had a mother? I mean, most rap records don't admit they even have a mother.
But, I was coming out of the early years of rap music, which were less about being tough and more about parties. So I mean, it was still out. What I was doing was still sort of out of place. But I was younger making rap records than a lot of the people that were my peers in the rap world at that time. So I was basically an old school rapper in with a new school crowd. So the style was based on there was a guy when I was coming up named Grandmaster Caz, and Grandmaster Caz used to make his party rhymes, but everything, it was always funny, and his rhymes always had a comedic edge to them. And essentially, I created my entire style after Grandmaster Caz. But I mean, he was as rare as I was. But the style is essentially based on being different. It's based upon doing something that will stand out and be as different as it could possibly be from all the other records that were being created at the time.
Now, did the persona on that record suit your real personality? I mean, was your mother really taking you to the Gallery, the shopping mall in Philadelphia, and buying you the wrong sneakers?
Oh yeah, my mom, she's really good at a lot of things, but the whole combination of clothes with the shoes, yeah, my mom wasn't like the best at that. You're good at it, Mom, now, but wow, you're in Philly, right? Yeah, so
yeah.
My mom's gonna be okay. Yeah, Mom, you weren't great at it, but you were good. But yes, it was tough some days, and it was even worse for my brother, because then after I was done with the stuff, he had to wear it old. At least I got to wear it new.
Well, how would you wear the wrong clothes to school? I mean, when you knew you were wearing clothes that you hated,
mm-hmm.
that other people that your friends would hate too.
Yeah, that's
that would make you look foolish. Yeah, what do you do so that you can still not look foolish in spite of what you're wearing?
You just hope that somebody else has worse clothes than you, so you know, so then you can ride them. And I was always pretty funny, so that being funny was a pretty good defense, because even if someone had nicer clothes on me, I could make the crowd think that their clothes were worse than mine just by the jokes.
Like what? What would you say?
Oh God, anything. I remember when Haggar washable slacks came out. And that's, you know, if you called somebody's pants Haggar washable reversible slacks, you know, and you just, you know, you show them flipping them inside and out. They wear them one way on Monday and flip them inside out on Tuesday. You know, and if, like, you know, you act that out physically, then you can generally make people laugh with that.
Will Smith recorded last December after the release of Ali. It's just come out on video and DVD. We'll hear more of the interview in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
It's rather extraordinary, so your bus is commentary. A literary genius and a superior beat creator have come together, and we made a musical composition, which we think is a remedy to cure all the dance floors that's empty. You wanna dance? We got what you want. Jazzy Jeff and Fresh Prince buzzing out with a brand new funk.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Moon Women by Pamela Duncan, available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, an interview with one of the greatest basketball players in the history of the NBA, Bill Russell. Also, rock historian Ed Ward on the British independent label Stiff Records. And we continue our interview with Will Smith. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with actor and rap music star Will Smith. He stars in the sequel Men in Black 2, which will be released in July. He received an Oscar nomination for his role as Muhammad Ali in the film Ali, which has just come out on video and DVD. I spoke with Will Smith last December when the film was released. No, you weren't from a poor family. Your mother worked for the school board. Your father owned a refrigeration business. Mm-hmm. Did you feel that being, you know... Did it feel like it would be more authentic if you did rap records if you were poor? You know, because sometimes authenticity in rap has been equated with being poor and being from a neighborhood where there's a lot of gang banging.
Well, I mean, the neighborhood that I was from was you know, working class neighborhood. I mean, it was we had our share of shootings and drug dealers. So, I mean, essentially, I am from the same type of neighborhood that those people are from. I just had I took a different approach. You know, there wasn't, you know, it wasn't something that I embraced. You know, I avoided the drug dealers and avoided the dudes shooting craps on the corners and all of that. It just wasn't something that I chose to embrace, but it was definitely something that was a part of my neighborhood.
No, I mean, you know, so many rap records are about standing up to the police, and you know, some of yours are about standing up to your parents.
Mm-hmm, right. Yeah, funny. You know, I mean, the thing is, it's like that's just not the aspect of my life that I was trying to embrace. I mean, as far as the run-ins with the police, I mean, I was 17 years old with a red IROC, so I had plenty of run-ins
right.
with the police and filed plenty of reports with internal affairs and reporting police and all that. I mean, the difference is that I always took the intellectual approach to dealing with the police. I know what the laws are, you know, police, you know, back then, the police, they had to have their hats on when they pulled your cars over. So if a cop got out the car and didn't have his hat on, I made sure I knew he didn't have his hat on.
And how would you do that?
I'd say, excuse me, sir, I do believe that your protocol dictates that you have to have your hat on in order to pull me over, so you can go get that.
And would they?
More times than not, they would. They would call you a really bad name, and then they would realize that you knew something if you knew that. So their approach was a little less. It would be more verbally offensive, but a lot less potentially physically offensive.
You're really good with rhymes, and your recordings tend to tell interesting stories. I mean, they could almost mm-hmm. be a sketch. Mm-hmm. Did you ever write stories?
Yeah, when I was probably 12 years old, 13 years old, I used to write stories about my friends, and I would make them superheroes, and I would sell them their story, you know, Super Terry, you know.
what powers you want to give me?
Yeah, you know, that's what we would talk about, and we would figure out what powers that you wanted to have and stuff like that, and then I would write a story where the kids were superheroes and, you know, sell them for, you know, 50 cents or a dollar or something like that. But I was doing that probably 12 years old to about 14 years old. I was doing that. My mother worked for the school board, and my grandmother was very much into education. So we were always writing and creating stories or reading Bible verses. So, I mean, we were always doing something literary.
So with your mother working for the school board, did she correct you a lot if you used improper grammar?
Oh yeah, we were.
Or slang
we were,
in your speech.
Yeah, we weren't allowed to use improper speech. You know, you would run out of the house. You say, "Yo, what's up? What y'all about to do?" And mother say, "Up, back in here, back." We would get on punishment for words like y'all. And, you know, you'd be in the house in the middle of the summer crying, and my grandmother would come up and say, "Baby, you know a y'all is a boat."
did that irritate you, or did you think, oh, I'm so glad that she's teaching me proper speech?
You know, yeah, it was, you know, that was, yeah, 12 years old. Oh, yeah, you know what? You're right, Grandma.
You're right.
Proper speech. That's, no, it was tough. But that's, I mean, that's something I've adapted in my life. I can't stop doing that to other people and to my kids. But I mean, very, very early, I remember that. I mean, it was just always important in my household to say things properly. I mean, in my neighborhood, kids would say, looked it. And my grandmother hated that, you know, kids, oh, he looked it crazy. Oh, man. My grandmother hated that. And that was one that you'd almost get a 30-day punishment for that one. If you said something looked it like something, woo!
Do you feel bilingual?
Well, you mean bilingual in the sense of King's English and Ebonics?
Yeah.
Or English and Spanish?
No.
You know, there's a certain bilingual element that all successful blacks have to have. You know, you have to be able to speak to the head of IBM in a way that gives confidence and communicates a sense of your commitment to excellence and perfection, and it all starts with language. But at the same time, you got to be able to relax and chill with your friends.
Will Smith recorded last December after the release of Ali. It's just come out on video and DVD. He stars in Men in Black 2, which will be released in July. Coming up, former NBA star Bill Russell. This is Fresh Air. As the NBA season climaxes, we're going to listen back to an interview with one of the greatest players in the history of basketball, Bill Russell. In his 13 years with the Boston Celtics, he helped lead his team to 11 championships. He was chosen the NBA's most valuable player 5 times. In 1967, Russell became the NBA's first African-American head coach when he replaced Celtics coach Red Auerbach. Russell served as player coach for 2 years, then retired as a player. For 4 years in the mid-70s, he was the head coach and general manager of the Seattle Supersonics. In 1980, the Professional Basketball Writers Association of America declared him the greatest player in the history of the NBA. In 1999, Sports Illustrated named the Boston Celtics the greatest team of the 20th century and Bill Russell the greatest team player in history. His book, Russell Rules, has just come out in paperback. I spoke with him last year when the book was first published. Russell revolutionized the defensive game. I asked him how he blocked the shots of his greatest opponent, Wilt Chamberlain, who was 5 inches taller than Russell.
When you jump to shoot, you cannot jump as high as you can. Because if you do, you won't be able to shoot at the end of the height. Because see, the shot starts in your feet and flows up to your body and leaves on your fingertips. And so most guys are good jumpers will jump as high as maybe as half as high as they can jump when they shoot offensively. Mm-hmm. The defensive player is not under those constraints. He can jump as high as he possibly can because he doesn't have to shoot at the end of the jump. And so when Wilt would take his fadeaway jump shot, first of all, I was left-handed. And so I didn't have to reach across my body to get to his right hand. So I picked up 3 inches right there. Then I could jump as high as I possibly can. He's limited to how high he can jump. So I pick up another 3 inches. So now I'm up with the ball. Now, but with him, if I did that too often, that would not be an intelligent thing for me to do. Because with all his physical talents, he was also very, very smart. And so if you did something to stop him, what he wanted to do, he would make adjustments. And you did not want him to make an adjustment. So what I would do sometimes is, rather than try to block the shot, is when he's setting up for the shot, push him another 2 inches away from the basket. That changes the angle. It's very, very minute, but it changes the angle. And so he's shooting from a different angle, and that will throw off the shots half of the time. And so he's shooting, and he's making some and he's missing some, but I want him to have the thought that it's just because he's just shooting, not shooting good. Not that I was harassing him. Because I didn't want him to ever think that I was harassing him. Because that would not be a good idea.
No, it sounds to me that you take a very analytical approach to the game.
Well, I wouldn't put it all like intelligence. You've got to remember now, this is not rocket science. This is a game that kids play.
In the days when you and Will Chamberlain were playing and part of your job was to prevent him from scoring, could you have become friends with him off the court? I mean, would you ever hang out together? Or was it best for you to not really get to know him as a friend and as a person so that you could just be more kind of cold and calculating on the court?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, I never tried to stop him from scoring. That would be a bad idea because, first of all, I'd be doomed to failure. To stop him from scoring, that wasn't going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
What my ambition was to make him less efficient. Say, if he gets 45 points.
Oh, right. Stop him from scoring as much. Yeah, that's what I meant. Yeah.
If he gets 45 points, if it took him 40 shots, then I've had a good night.
Right.
You understand me?
Yes.
Okay. As for friends, for 5 or 6 years, we had a Thanksgiving night game in Philadelphia at Convention Hall. In the middle of the afternoon, Wilt would come to the hotel, pick me up, and we go to his house. And he came from a large family, 6 or 7 kids, you know. And I would have Thanksgiving dinner with his mother and father and his sisters and brothers. And then his mother, bless her, would let me go and get in his bed and take a nap. And then we go to the game and just kick the hell out of each other.
And that was okay, huh? It didn't inhibit your ability to kick the hell out of him after, you know, his mother made your Thanksgiving dinner.
No, and it didn't bother him either. He didn't mind kicking the hell out of me. In fact, one of those nights he got 55 rebounds.
Right.
Against us. And so he was not inhibited in any way, shape, form, or fashion. Because, you know, when we got on the court, we were determined to outplay each other.
Right.
Now, the outplaying each other was for him to do what he did for his team as well as possible, and for me to do what I did for my team as well as possible, which were two different things.
Here's a really important question. How do you feel about the longer, baggier shorts that players wear today compared to the shorter, tighter ones that players wore in your day?
Well, see, when we were young and energetic and the young ladies could see our thighs,
yeah,
we thought that was very attractive. But do you know how the long shorts came to be?
No, I don't.
Well, that's another thing we can thank my good friend, Michael Jordan. What happened was when he went to the Bulls, now this is a story that I've been told. When he went to the Bulls, he was, like all of us, he had some superstitions. So what he did was he wore his North Carolina blue and white shorts under his Bulls shorts. And so every time he'd fall or go do something like that, you could see that blue underneath. Well, from what I hear, the commissioner called and says, hey, listen, that's out of uniform. You cannot have that showing. So rather than stop wearing his shorts, he had his Bulls shorts made longer so they would cover up the blue. And so when Michael starts wearing longer shorts, and Michael was the man. And so everybody started wearing it. Hey, if Michael's wearing them, it's good enough for him. If that works for him, maybe I'll try it. Might help. And so all these guys are getting long and longer shorts. I just think it's amusing as heck. You know? And then that's, you know, in this culture, we have a hair thing. When Bill Walton was really playing great at Portland, he wore a ponytail and a beard. And, oh, people up in arms about that. You know, athletes are not supposed to do that. That's for the hippies, you know. And then when I was a rookie, I hadn't started shaving, so I had a beard. And you have no idea how much conversation about the beard, which had nothing to do with anything. And now these guys are wearing these, they call cornrows. And the white guys can't do that. But when I was playing, a lot of the white guys grew crew cuts. I couldn't do that. And so, you know, it's like, it's just so funny to me when I see things that that people get upset about.
Right, and how things go in and out of fashion.
Yeah, yeah, you know.
Bill Russell, one last question. Can you still jump? Do you have any reason to jump?
I jump with joy sometimes because that's an integral part of my life. One of the first things I remember as a kid was running along and just jumping, just for the joy. I think jumping is really, really, really important part of our psyche. You can jump for many reasons, you know, and this is an expression. And so, now I don't try to dunk anymore. I go for more pedestrian type of activities nowadays. So there's a place where if I have to get one place to the other, I'd rather walk than run. So then when I get there, I can do whatever I want to do instead of having to sit down and rest for 10 minutes.
Yeah, right. Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Terry Gross, you have no idea what a thrill it is to converse with you.
Bill Russell, recorded last year after the publication of his book, Russell Rules. It's just been published in paperback. Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward on Stiff Records. This is Fresh Air. The punk era was ushered in by bored teenagers on independent labels. This is pretty well known. But what may not be remembered as well is that the first of those independent labels started in Britain with a couple of bored non-teens with a wacky sense of humor that caused them to name their label Stiff. Rock historian Ed Ward has the story of a brief, glorious era of wackiness.
Oh, yes, I love my label. She's so good and kind. Together we will pave our destiny. My label always loves to hear some pretty chords on its records like these ones. She's always pleased to hear some of these pretty melodies.
Nick Lowe had good reason to love his label. After all, he'd been instrumental in starting it, and he'd done a lot of work for it since its inception. The label in question, of course, was Stiff, one of the looniest commercial ventures of all time. Stiff was born in 1976 at the hands of Jake Riviera and Dave Robinson, both of whom had started in the music biz as roadies and worked their way up into becoming managers and presences on England's pub rock scene. Like a small but vocal minority at the time, they thought music was boring, at least what was getting recorded, and they decided to do something about it and approached Nick Lowe, bassist with the recently disbanded Brinsley Schwartz Band, for some of his publishing demos, two of which got pressed up as the first Stiff single.
Well, in the heart of the city, where the alligator roam, I'm a little lost lamb, ain't got no place to go. I ain't got one penny, just got a shirt on my back. I left home in a hurry, but I ain't never going back. I'm looking for a home in the heart of the city.
Heart of the City and So It Goes were so different from what was out there that the record got immediate press, if no airplay. This was good. Neither Robinson nor Riviera was averse to publicity, and they made sure each new Stiff record stood out. Each had a picture sleeve, many had weird messages scratched in the outgroove, and you never knew what to expect when you touched the needle to the plastic. And that's how history gets made.
Is she really going out with him?
Like a stormy sea. I don't know why, I don't know why. I guess these things have gotta be. I've got a new rose, I've got a good. Guess I knew that I always would. I can't stop to mess around. I got a brand new rose in town.
People may quibble, but most agree that The Damned's New Rose was the first British punk single. Produced by Nick Lowe, it enjoyed a modest chart success and attracted more attention, causing New Yorker Richard Hell to offer Stiff rights to his Blank Generation EP, the first transatlantic punk record. But for all that, the Stiff aesthetic was more traditional, and their next big artist was actually one of the younger pub rockers.
Calling Mr. Ozzel with a swastika tattoo. There is a vacancy waiting in the English voodoo carver. Bar's head, when it's had enough for that, maybe you'll take him to bed to teach him he's alive, or he wishes he was dead. Turn up the TV, no one listening will suspect, even your mother won't detect it, so your father won't know. They think that I got no respect, but everything means less.
Elvis Costello established Stiff internationally, particularly after he signed with Columbia in the United States. At last, the label was making a little money, and the artist roster was getting more interesting every day.
Sex and drugs and rock and roll is all my brain and body need. Sex and drugs and rock and roll.
Ian Dury was an older chap with crutches due to childhood polio, an art instructor whose band The Blockheads seemed to be mostly jazzers. Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll may be his best-remembered song, but his beautiful Cockney-accented vignettes of London life, like My Old Man, were exquisitely crafted. By 1978, punk was part of the landscape, and new wave was the new catchword. Stiff, predictably, was on top of it, producing a record which may sound like a parody today, but which was perfectly serious at the time.
Make me
In 1979, Stiff was on top of the world despite Jake Riviera's defection with his new management clients Elvis Costello and Nick Lowe, and they decided it was time to announce the next big thing, the Akron sound. Akron had, it's true, brought the world Devo, but neither the painful Jane Eyre nor teenage Rachel Sweet had much staying power. Actually, the act which saved Stiff's bacon was right in their backyard.
Hey, you! Don't watch that! Watch this! This is the heavy, heavy monster sound! The nuttiest sound around! So if you're coming off the street and you're beginning to feel the heat, well, listen, Buster, you better start to move your feet to the rockin'est, rock-steady beat of madness! One step beyond!
Madness was immense, gigantic, and the most commercially successful of all the neo-ska bands, which ushered in the 80s. Although they continued to be signed to Stiff until 1984, the label had clearly seen its day by 1981. There were occasional inspired records, but too many stupid novelties. Stiff died in 1986, although it was revived by outsiders for a while, but it left behind memories of the days when it really lived up to its motto, "If it's not Stiff, it's not worth a..."
Ed Ward lives in Berlin. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
I remember the night the kid cut off his right arm. Did a bit to save a bit of power. He got 50,000 watts in a big acoustic tower. Security's so tight tonight. Oh, they're ready for a tussle. Gotta keep your backstage passes, 'cause your promoter has the muscle. And so it goes, and so it goes, and so it goes, and so it goes.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by National Geographic, featuring travel products including guidebooks, maps, magazines, and trips, available in stores nationwide or online at nationalgeographic.com, and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the South African Carmen. The directors of a British opera company went to the townships to audition singers for a South African production of Carmen that was also a hit in London's West End and is now at the Spoleto Festival in South Carolina. We'll meet the music director and the two South African stars of Carmen. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.